Ready? You know the drill, don't you? With
yeah,
things.
Do it.
Croeso, welcome. It is Podcast O'Clock. My name is Russell, and I have the very great pleasure of the company of Lord Daniel Evans of Porthcawl.
Thanks for having me on.
Like you'd ever accept a gong from the British state.
No, I would, man. If it was offered to me, I'd like completely sell out and take it.
How are you, okay?
I'm alright, mate. Yeah, thanks very much for having me on.
Well, I mean, this has been pushed back more times than Exit in the EU, isn't it?
Sadly.
And
sadly with a podcast, like.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about an article you had in... I've written the current edition of Planet, the Welsh Internationalist. I went online just to check a couple of things, and they've brought out another one since.
Have they? Yeah. Oh, I wasn't asked to contribute to that.
And it's only quarterly, so that shows right, how long this has been
knocking about.
It's episode 81, so if episodes were caps, we'd be one behind Wayne Hennessy, so we'll do a dubious wave to him. I went on to your podcast, which we can
Our best ever one, I reckon.
I unanimously
voted the best ever Desolation Radio episode.
You should do that on Twitter. You should do those kind of votes and do like a World Cup of Desolation Radio episodes. You're about 50 in as well now, aren't you?
54, just gone. So kudos to making to 81, man, because it's so hard, it's unbelievable.
You do one, and then you just want to do two, and then you want to kind of get to a third. And I honestly, and I've said this before, I honestly, when we first started, and it was the friendly we had against the Netherlands before the 2014 World Cup.
Yeah.
So it's 5 years coming up, and I just remember thinking I would probably run out of stuff to say in like maybe, I don't know, 18 months, and like 5 years on, and
I'm
talking about Welsh cultural periodicals.
It's probably the hardest thing you can ever do, I would say. It's harder than running marathons.
It's a labour of love.
What, doing podcasts?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it is hard though, isn't it? Obviously, I've been busy ostracising most of our fan base for the last few weeks. Like, that's the hardest thing for me, is you sort of take it for granted that you have like your tribe and your political, the people you've got things in common with, and gradually find out I don't have that much. Like, I do have obviously many things in common, like, you know, wanting Welsh independence and stuff, but then within that, there are like points of tension. That's been the hardest thing for me to sort of take, really.
But that in itself, it's not a homogenous thing, is it? I think that comes out in the article that you wrote, so we'll talk about a bit more of that, and probably kind of getting into the guts of this a bit too prematurely, but the spectrums, there's kind of like a fluidity of things, isn't there? There's,
yeah, absolutely.
Entities and allegiances and everything else. So okay, before we do get into the guts of it, you wrote the article for Planet. It was issue 233. And for anyone who doesn't know, Planet, the Welsh Internationalist, is quite a long-running period.
Yeah, I mean, Planet's amazing. It was started by Ned Thomas in the 70s as an editor. He was the original editor, I believe. Probably got that wrong. I mean, Planet is iconic, like, I think. I mean, if you look at some of the people who've contributed and written, you know, for it over the years, even the design of the cover, like, the range of the topics covered, and the best thing about writing for Planet is they let... Like, well, Emily, the editor, is amazing. And compared to some publications you write for, certainly compared to, like, academia, where, you know, it's, like, the most soul-destroying thing ever, trying to write something and it gets destroyed and you have no sense of ownership once you actually finish the finished product. You're just like, oh, I don't even recognise what I wrote. Whereas with Planet, you sort of... They give you an interesting topic to write about and you can write about it in your own way. And it's just a really good experience.
And so shout out to Emily Traherry, obviously the editor. I had a chat with her and she was, you know, really encouraging of us doing this. And, you know, I was a bit worried that, you know, if we talk about this, does it give people a reason or excuse not to buy it? And she was just like, no, anything that raises the profile is good. And actually is sort of, you know, quite welcoming then of other contributions that would be around, you know, different aspects
absolutely.
Of culture. Because it is about culture, society, politics. There's stuff in there about kind of, you know, rock music, stuff about museums.
It's amazing.
Poetry, like, the environment. It's really quite breadth and diverse, isn't
it? Yeah, it's amazing. And like the thing is, it's like, it's all we've got in Wales really as a, you know, English language, in the English language, sort of our culture and politics as a magazine. And it manages to walk this awesome, I mean, you know, it is like I guess highbrow, but it's not inaccessible. It's amazing, you know. It's, what have we got? We've got Wales Online, which is, you know, shit. And then you've got, it really is Planet, which is, yeah, it's just a brilliant resource. So everyone subscribes to Planet. It's only like 20 quid a year.
Absolutely. You describe yourself in it as a recovering academic.
Yeah.
So what do people need to know about you? What's your vital stats?
6'5", 250. So my PhD was on essentially Welsh identity in Porthcawl. I'll talk about it this in the article because my whole interest in everything in politics, I guess, comes from growing up in Porthcawl, really. I'm kind of obsessed with Porthcawl. You know, I've got Porthcawl tattoos. Like, I just... But it's a really interesting place because it always seemed to be like un-Welsh, for want of a better word, and particularly when I used to play football, because Porthcawl's in the Talbot League, and you know, we play all the teams from, you know, Avon Lido, up the Avon Valley, you know, Glencorrow, Cymer, and all that, Carmarthen, and we just get slaughtered every week, you know, for calling us English, you know, posh bastards, things like that. So from a really young age, I always had this like obvious interest that Porthcawl was like very different from the surrounding areas, even like the villages like Canerley, Kenfigil, which are only like 5 miles away, entirely different accents. I did my PhD on Welsh identity in Porthcawl. Then I was working in Cardiff Uni for 4 years doing education research for the Wizard and like the Welsh Government and stuff. And then I got made redundant. And now I'm a support worker working with Rough Sleepers in Cardiff, which is, you know, a big...
Proper job.
Yeah, proper job, a hard job, yeah.
Makes a difference.
Yeah, basically. I'm a nice guy. I like to help people, you know. But also... You know, I can actually enjoy writing again now, and one of the reasons I enjoyed writing that article so much, I think it was the first article I wrote, or one of the first articles I had published since I'd left academia. And obviously leaving academia, you have this big existential like crisis, because I'd probably attach my identity to being like a lecturer and a researcher and stuff. You know, that's what you tell women and things, and what you tell people. You know, but like fundamentally in academia, I didn't enjoy it at all, and certainly didn't enjoy like the writing and the pressure they put on you to publish in particular journals. And, you know, ultimately no leading journals want to hear anything about Wales, you know. And so actually getting this done and kind of being asked to write about like my dream topic, really, I was like, shit, I can actually maybe do a normal job and also get to do stuff that I find interesting and fulfilling on the side.
Yeah.
But it is hard, isn't it, to do stuff on top of a normal job. Like,
So you did Desolation.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Started out 3-4 years ago?
I think it was, not two.
Two, okay.
2 years ago, yeah.
Feels already part of the...
Iconic, like.
I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, because I think, and I have said this before, and I've said this on this podcast, I think in terms of like civil society in Wales, so, you know, we're going beyond politics, you know, we're reaching out into society, I think that is probably the best addition to Welsh civil society in a long time, and it's lit a fire under issues and things, and you talk about Planet being accessible, and you've made topics accessible. So criminal justice, policing, prisons, political theory, you know, Gramsci, all that kind of stuff that you've done race, you've done gender, you've done the Rebecca riots. So it's just like, I remember them in school. You begin to realise that this stuff is all connected, it is all interlinked, and it's fascinating to be able to listen to this stuff without, like, you know, to be fair, you touch on this in terms of media around the Welsh football team, it's not patronised by public funding, by politicians, by politics, big P, little P, all the rest of that. It's independent, it's autonomous. I think the fact that it's a labour of love is probably a part of the broad appeal, and so all credit to you. I mean, some huge minds, I mean, not just mine, obviously, but some huge brains on there, like, you know, Calvin and...
Yeah, man.
I'm trying to think, Hugh and Tegid.
Yeah.
Mark Hooper.
Yeah.
Barry Town's biggest fan.
Yeah, all the greats.
I think that just shines a light on some really fundamentally critical things that affect...
Yeah, like the frustrating... The podcast has been amazing to do, to be fair. The best thing about it, it's like the best of Wales, really, because we started doing the podcast... We just started like messaging people on Twitter, like, oh, do you want to come on the podcast? And I think it's one of the strengths of Wales that everyone was like, oh, yeah, of course, you know. And you can just like, you know, hit up like Calvin, you know, he's like fairly famous, like professor of economics, to just come on and and you've got no problem with it at all. And I think that's, I don't know whether you could be, do that in other countries, maybe not.
My understanding of economy, because this was one of the early ones, my understanding of economy, and was it either a two-part or he did two, I can't quite remember now, or there was a very like a companion one with somebody else.
No, Mark did like Introduction to Economics and Calvin did one as well.
Yeah, and my understanding of economics was like increased by, you know, significant. And that's the point, isn't it? You can present a fairly complex topic, but you know, it does take an art and a skill to be able to, as indeed the best educationalists at any level are able to do, to communicate that, make it accessible, but to make it relevant as well. And it can't just be dry and highbrow and all the rest of it. It's got to appeal to
People. Yeah,
normal. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's been amazing actually being able to chat and, you know, meet people through it. That's been the best thing, and the actual support you get, you know, you get people just helping you, wanting to help, you know, people asking to, you know, because we're so incompetent, we were like, oh, I don't know anything about how to record, and then all of a sudden people were just like, oh, you know, well, we'll come and help you do this, and then we crowdfunded for the mixer and things like that. And but it's also been like, it's depressing in a way, because you're speaking to people who are so interesting. And you're thinking, well, in a way, just like the article, you're thinking, why aren't these people represented? Why can't these people be on, you know, BBC, or why can't they be on, like, have their own show on TV and things? And you just think, it would be so much better. But I'm sure that one day, that, you know, day will come and we will be in charge, basically.
And I suppose there's things then, like you know, Nation Cymru, and, you know, there's other things happening. You've got the podcast, which I quite like. It's Welsh language, but again, it's talking about other things. It's just giving an air and a profile to topics that, like you said, that don't tend to get an airing. And you see what we had in this week about, you know, the big kind of smiling, big, huge centrefold, almost double page spread in the Western Mail of Nigel Farage looking like he's that kind of everyman, about how he's no more Mr. Nice Guy. And you think, this is deeply pernicious.
That's awful.
And fortunately, like, you know, barely anybody reads Wales on, you know, Western Mail, which is, you know, but it'll be read by some people, and that's the point. It'll be sitting in a doctor's waiting room, you know, where it should be Planet sitting in a doctor's waiting room, you know. And it's that's the real kind of frustration.
And fundamentally, there are just huge issues. Like Nathan and I were talking, I was like, massive, terrible things happen in Wales all the time in politics and the decisions that are made by the Welsh government. And the worst thing for me, well, obviously it is bad that the government make those decisions, and obviously we should look at how they actually arrive at those and who actually influences them. But it's more the fact that, you know, things get happen and then just no one says anything. Like, no one says anything in academia. You know, no politician say anything. You know, no one in the media says anything. And because Wales is so, like, cosy and everyone knows everyone, and no one dares, like, speak out lest they lose funding. Or you do rapidly become, like, a pariah if you have a go at, like, the Welsh government. It would almost be easier in England, where the Tory government is so, like, obviously sort of evil. But then at least you have people opposing it. Whereas in Wales, there's this broad, crappy, tokenly social democratic, like mainly liberal consensus, where the Welsh government do something which is like obviously bad, and they say, well, we've come up with this amazing plan, you know, for like childcare, for example, and everyone just goes like, oh yeah, this is so awesome. Tuition fees being, I'm hijacking the football podcast, so like you might tell people to fast forward, but it's a classic example. You know, they say, oh, Wales has the most progressive tuition fee settlement, you know, anywhere in the UK, and people have just been like, oh yeah, okay. And then you think, well, it's free in Scotland, right? And then you actually look at the stats, and Wales is, you know, pound for pound, is more expensive to go to university in Wales than it is in America. You know, it's one of the most regressive tuition fee regimes in the world. And they just get people, they're just allowed to get away with it. Yeah. And yeah, like that was the fundamental point of the podcast, just to say, well, actually, that's a load of bollocks.
Yeah.
It has made us pariahs, I think.
Your news roundup at the start of each one is the funniest black comedy around.
It's just bleak, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I think we're going to stop doing that now, because, like, we do it, and like this, you know, we listen, we do so many podcasts, we listen to back, and it's like, we've recorded the introduction, then we do half the podcast, and Nathan sort of tends to fall asleep, and then we go, oh, I'll come back to this, and then 6 months later, we pick it up, and then we re-listen to it, and it's like, we can't actually do that anymore, because it's not current.
It's similar to that notion that I feel sorry in current politics for the satirists, because
yeah, you can't.
It is now, your real life is just ridiculous.
Yes.
So was it today? I can't think it was one of the Tory AMs saying how, you know, the proposed smacking ban might put off English tourists.
Yeah, because you want to come in, you can't knock your kids around when you come over the border.
If that was on the day amazing. Today, or Brass Eye, yeah, or Chris Morris, it's like, it is up there with bomb dogs.
Oh yeah, absolutely, it is. It's surreal. Janet Finch-Saunders, it was, it did it.
No relation to Dean. No. Finch and Saunders, hopefully. I haven't followed a Premier League season in about 15 years.
Yeah.
I go to university in 1995, you meet all these people from across the UK we're at Bristol, and Monday Night Football was brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
And it was actually quite innovative when games were always Saturdays, midweek evenings, Sunday afternoons. So funny, Monday night in the pub, in the student bars, and it brought an excitement to it. And of course, because you've got people from all over the UK, then you get a bit of spice because of different allegiances and everything else. Galaxy on Soccer Sunday, 12:30 on a Sunday, production value for which was
not great,
but it was ours, and that's an important factor. But it wasn't Monday Night Football, and it didn't have John Barnes in outrageous suits and Barry Venison still with his mullet. Plus, by this point, Mike Smith and Bobby Gould are in charge, and it is horrifically
bad. Oh, yeah, yeah.
When you talk in the actual, I've got it here in front of me, when you scribble a note about how, sorry, when you say about how going to watch the game didn't mean Wales, it meant England, for me, my abiding memory is kind of like, Wales were on TV, BBC Wales had the rights, which was great, hangover from the end of the Euro era. When you watch the game, even all the Welsh boys going, well, no, not really, Russ.
Because it's so bad.
It was absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So, massive kudos to, one or two exceptions. My English mate, Jason, Indy has been on Twitter, give him a follow. Grimsby Town fan, so kind of could probably, understand the crushing disappointment. And he was, yeah, come on, we'll watch it. And when you get to that point, when you're in a Welsh university, you're in a cradle of Welsh radicalism, intelligentsia, the universities, the Trevechan sit-ins, all of that thing in Aberystwyth, and no fucker wants to watch the game.
Yeah.
And you're kind of struggling to round the troops up. That's really demoralising, but you still kind of do it. And then we would get, pumped 5-0 by Georgia, obviously. So, yeah, dark, dark days.
Absolutely.
So, an egalitarian, debauched, travelling statelet. Statelet is now my new favourite word in English language, by the way.
It means a baby state.
And it's entitled Ambassadors for Travelling Statelet Fans Culture at Home and Away. So you've written about how, what you're doing is celebrating Welsh football fan culture, but not necessarily the clubs per se. It's about the national team.
Absolutely, yeah.
And how it has its own, and has developed its own, and we've talked about this as well, but it's developed its own sort of musical scene. There's a uniform, it's on grassroots media, and this ethos of egalitarian hedonism, which I quite like, actually. But there's other key elements that it's self-organised. The Welsh language, so it's bilingual, the Welsh language is pretty much completely uncontested.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's practically unique in Wales. The only other example I can find, and a friend of mine who works in the voluntary arts, community arts sector said, and it equates that, it's kind of like male voice choir culture,
yeah.
Or even actually people who the rest of their time would be perhaps ambivalent at best, hostile perhaps towards Welsh language, will pride themselves on perfect phonetic pronunciation of Mavanwy and all of these hymns, and it's utterly uncontested.
Absolutely.
And actually male voice choir that can't sing Welsh hymns ain't really trying.
Yeah.
So these things are rare where that's uncontested, and that there's an inclusivity to it across gender, across language. It unites a country that's travel infrastructure is beyond appalling, and gives people not just a means of expressing. I think this is the really important thing about the article. It doesn't just give people a means of expressing those things in a safe, inclusive environment, etc., etc. It actually gives people an insight into how other countries do things.
Absolutely.
They organise, how they welcome people, how they have their own transport infrastructure. And so what was the motive behind doing it?
I was asked. No, I mean, I've actually thought about an article like this for ages and ages and ages because, doing my PhD, which was about Welsh identity in Porthcawl, I came across all the exact same things that you did. So basically, all my mates when I was younger supported England in football. Everyone used to wear England shirts. There is a high percentage of people who are English in Porthcawl, people whose parents are English. But it's not as simple as that. I think it comes to do with this, the fact that we used to be awful, but also this complete imbalance in coverage and things like that, and the fact that it's the game, England are always at the major competitions.
Fair to the Glencorrig and the Carmarthen boys, they
had a point. Yeah. But I remember seeing lads wearing England shirts up there in the valleys, even with Beckham on the back, because England was so massive and dominant in the media that we consume that they almost became a club team. Mm. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't seen as the English. It was almost it was seen as completely natural to support England. And apparently, by the way, I spoke to Martin Johns and things about this, because I always remember, you know, John Humphreys, like the ghoulish Radio 4 presenter now, because he's, you know, he's from, I think he's from Bewtown, isn't he? Or is he from Grange? Or something like that. But I mean, I always remember when I used to read like papers, he wrote an article about sport or whatever, and he was like, I remember growing up in, you know, Cardiff in the 60s, and, you know, we all massive street parties when, you know, England won the 1966 World Cup. And I was like, what? And then we did, like, you know, apparently that, you know, was the case very much. You know, people were supporting England in Wales back then.
Bob Humphreys was the best Humphreys, I think we can all.
Yeah. They were taking for granted, fourth quarter, you know, the game meant, you know, watching England. It always used to really wind me up. And it was probably football that got me thinking about Porthcawl's sort of status as a Welsh or not very Welsh town. And so it's really my experience of trying to follow Wales in football, which essentially prompted my PhD, because you start thinking, like, hang on, this isn't right. And what is it about Porthcawl that's so different? Like, why do all my mates support England? But then obviously I went to uni in Aber, like you, and it was exactly the same in Aber. You know, all the pubs would fly England flags when England were playing in the Euros. It just wound me up so much in this. Yeah, you said about, you know, being a Wales football fan, like, inspires this sort of obdurate, it's not being a contrarian, but, like, I always remember in youth club, like, after school, they'd show, like, you know, during the World Cup in, like, or whatever, or I would turn up in, like, a Germany shirt, or I'd ask my parents every year, even as, like, a teenager, to buy me, like, because my birthday's in, like, July, please buy me X shirt. And it would always be, like, Croatia, Germany, all the teams that England were going to play, who knocked them out, you know. And that's been, like, a tradition of mine. So I've got all these, like, random shirts of different countries, and ostentatiously cheering, you know, when England get knocked out, like, ha! And people just didn't get it, you know. I remember they looked at me as if...
It is contrarian.
But they would look at me in school, and I remember doing it with, like, watching around my mate's house, and they just looked at me as if I was just really nasty and, like, cruel, and, like, what a vile person you are to, like, cheer to want, you know, England to lose. You know, I think how upset the players are. And all my mates were, like, upset. And I'd be like, ha, this is class. But it was just frustration that, you know, we were, like, that, you know, as you said, how ridiculous it is that you'd have to, like, watch the Wales game in the corner of a pub in a tiny TV, or while everyone else is watching England on the massive screen.
And there's lots of people that have had those experiences.
Yeah, and then
they watch it with the sound down.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. And what I think inculcates is, like, the thing is, I mean, part of it is a reaction against what I would call, like, Wales's, like, official identity. So it could have been a very negative polemic against, like, how Wales is represented to the world, how we're brought up to think about Welshness and things, which I think is, like, bound up with, you know, rugby, which is bound up with militarism and certain views of Wales. And so I normally write, like, polemics and rants, but it was actually, I was like, you know, I'll write something positive. I think if you grow up, you've grown up in that, like, environment of watching Wales, then you almost become a bit of a nationalist without thinking about it, because within the sociology of national identity is generally this passive thing that we have, right? It's like sociologists tend to panic about national identity, especially in places who are, like, that are liminal, or where people have ambivalent identity or whatever. But the reality is, for most people, you know, it's not an issue, really. They don't think about it that much. But when you talk to people about what your national identity is, they say there's like the raw materials of national identity, and that is things like, you know, birthplace, being raised in a country, or my parents were born here, things like that. Those are the normal things. So it's quite passive. But what you find is, when people actually start to think about it more, it's generally when they've had to leave the country and start to talk about where they're from to people and compare their own country to the country they're in, that makes them sort of aware for the first time of their national identity. And so what you're doing when you go abroad, and this is what we'll talk about a little bit later, is, you know, you're doing something active. You're actually starting to think for the first time about, like, what the difference is about where you're from compared to the, you know, what's the difference to the place that you're actually going on holiday, for example. And watching Wales, even in a little telly in a pub, or, you know, trying to drag your mates to watch Wales with you, in your case, is that you've actually started to be a bit more active about your national identity, and you've actually started to almost, like, think about it. And one of the things, like, a lot of football fans now, I think, on Twitter from Wales, like, really don't like rugby, and let's not get into that, but what they say, they don't like the 80-minute, they call them 80-minute Patriots, because you only think about Wales and Welshness for a small amount a year. And what I would say about rugby is that well, rugby definitely serves a purpose in like Welsh national identity, but the Six Nations has become a very unthinking expression of Welshness, and rugby has, because it's part of like the official narrative. Whereas football fans, I think, are generally more, tend to be more nationalistic, because you've always had to sort of, well, fight to sort of watch it. But also, if you're watching something that is a bit niche because we've been so bad, then it's almost like you've put a lot of your own time and emotion into it, and you've had to start of like fight a little bit more.
Yeah, because you've had to carve out a space. Or if actually everyone else is almost kind of consciously, or not maybe literally, maybe, but metaphorically, you know, turning their back on it or rejecting it, then it's that actually there's only me and maybe a few others who are actually, you know, giving a shit. And
Patriots, like, no, but no, and there's an additional layer that I didn't mention in the article, where Porthcawl is very much a rugby town, and you know, my school is very much a rugby school, and you know, you're literally like forced to play rugby. And then when I stop playing rugby because I want to play football, you know, you get all sorts of abuse from like PE teachers and things. So you have to make like an active choice, you know, to opt out of this like official rugby is Welshness and is bound up with your masculinity and all that jazz. Again, we won't go into that. So my Welsh identity has almost entirely been bound up with football, going to watch, you know, us in the Arms Park and things like that. It's always been this really sort of special thing.
And so, and I think this has come through loud and clear, but I mean, you know, on the first page, you say that your sense of Welsh identity is almost entirely bound up with football, quote unquote.
Yeah, I mean, and because in Porthcawl, especially, you know, it's not seen as being a very Welsh place. My childhood was, well, teenage years really, was Cool Cymru and all these, you know, it's a bit of a terrible term, I think, the Manics, the Stereophonics. And I always remember watching the Phonics in Cardiff Castle. I think that was like the second gig I went to, and you know, I think the first album's amazing by the Stereophonics, but you know, Evan's chanting like Wales, Wales, and like they're playing like loops of like rugby on before and during like the gig, and it was very much like this rugby, but it's also like this like very particular type of Welshness. It's like this Valleys Welshness, and I remember they were selling t-shirts, you know, like Valleys Boy and things like that, and I remember being like genuinely gutted that I can't actually wear this because I'm not from the Valleys, I'm from Porthcawl, which is this like, you know, English place, you know, apparently, that isn't really Welsh. And so within that, you know, all you've got is like, well, I support Wales in football, you know, that's like my thing you have to cling on to, is that, you know, I am Welsh, I support I support Wales in football. And I could say to people, you know, I'd always like people who I knew from the Valleys or whatever, I was like, you know, you support Wales and rugby, but you know, they support England in football. And so it's like almost this the thing I sort of cling on to, really.
And this does, I'm not for a second saying this doesn't exist in rugby, it does. But of course, very, very few people from North Wales have ever represented Wales.
Oh, yeah, of course.
My understanding, my very, very early nascent, I mean, I never went to North Wales with my family. I mean, we did. I mean, like, the furthest north I ever went to was Bilth.
Yeah, most people have not.
For like a scout jam.
I've not been
there. In the Royal Welsh, you know. My understanding of North Wales geography was seeing on things like, you know, sticker albums and, you know, books referring to people like, you know, Ian Rush and Kevin Ratcliffe.
And all Boyne.
You know, it's Mancot and it's Flint and it's Llandudno and it's these places that I might have heard of, or in the case of someone like Mancot, Queensferry, never heard of. And actually then kind of going, where's that?
Yeah, where's,
you
know, that?
Look and find that out and recognising, oh, it's that bit up there. And from a very young age, you're conscious of the shape of Wales because it's presented in an awful lot of ways to you. But there's no detail to that.
No.
Yeah. My degree at Aberystwyth was geography and Welsh. So I mean, this sense of place and space has always been something that's appealed to me and interested me. But I would actually kind of, you know, get out a map and kind of go, "Ooh, Flint. Oh, that's it's really close to England."
I can't remember if it was
and things like that. And so begin to understand things about the country you're in. So like I said, that passive nationality begins to take on a bit more kind of colour and a bit more kind of definition.
Yeah,
and a
definitely.
Bit more flesh and meaning. Through football.
There's, I don't know if it was the Panini sticker books or maybe it was Wales programmes, but they used to do birthplace and all of the birth. I mean, is it St Asaph? Is the hospital or whatever?
Yeah.
But I was just like, man, everyone's born in this one.
Yeah.
And then because all the players from North Wales, you know, were all tend to be born in this hospital, I started to think my sense of Welshness was always bound up with football. I mean, I always supported Wales in rugby as well, obviously. Yeah. And you know, we actually started getting alright at rugby at some stage. I think when I was in uni, we actually used to like start beating England. But I've got to say as well, I mean, like the thing I omitted, I sort of touch on it, that you know, we were so, like, we were bad. I mean, I had this massive authentic imposter syndrome when like writing it, because obviously I haven't done like that many aways, and then the harsh reality is that I essentially stopped going to home games as well for quite a long period after watching Wales. You know, my first experiences of like football was like watching Wales, and then it was like watching Liverpool play in London, because my family live in London, so I'd watch like first ever games in White Hart Lane, and then it was in Sellers Park and things like that. But I think, yeah, when I went to uni, first I fell out of love with football, because I think I was just overdosed on football. I think the last game I watched for ages was when we got beaten in the Millennium Stadium against Finland, the 2-0, and that like Bellamy like cries afterwards in the post-match interview with frustration, because he's like they're not a good team, how have we lost to them, basically. And I also think, by the way, that like Bellamy is so unfortunate to have been like our best player in it and not particularly good like batch of players for ages.
But you see, that's, I think that's what's interesting, that it comes through. So you talk about, and a key quote is, it's the bit where he quotes this Benedict Anderson. I don't know who he is, but this notion that sport, amongst other things, this reinforces these narratives about, so these heroic narratives that nations and countries are great, and we're moral and we're upstanding and we've done good things to the world, and you know, there's plenty of countries that clearly have them, you know. And I kind of read that and I kind of thought, well, actually that's the point, isn't it? A lot of the rugby bit,
yeah, it's tied into,
reinforces
it.
That, absolutely, it? The militarism and all that kind of thing.
But also this heroic, like the Welsh and Flair way of playing, like JPR Williams, Gareth Edwards, and all like these amazing tries.
Prince of Wales.
Yeah.
And Barry John was the king. And it is actually, when you begin to pick it apart, you begin to think there's a lot of royalist type sort of language attached to it.
But I also think the main thing about rugby is that, and those players, we're world renowned for being amazing. Yeah. And the thing about rugby is, like, you know, there is a bit of a heroic narrative of, like, you know, we are, you know, a talented sort of nation. And the thing about Benedict Anderson, when he says nations are imagined, it means that, you know, nations like basically invent their own traditions, and no nation really, you know, for example, like, you know, look at the Gaelic sport in Ireland, you know, that's something that was like brought back in like the 19th century, and like kilts and tartan in Scotland, is obviously they have historic roots, otherwise they wouldn't ever catch on, but they're not something that has been going since time immemorial. They're brought back by nationalists as a way of sort of cultivating a new myth about Scotland and Ireland that happens in all countries.
Yeah.
That's what they call like an invented tradition, basically. But yeah, there's always this thing that, you know, you read about, because, you know, I am technically a sociologist of nationalism and national identity, and all these things, you know, it's like all nations tell themselves these heroic narratives about how, you know, unique they are and amazing they are. I mean, there's a lot of it done about the sociology of sport, and I remember reading one about like England rugby analysis of, like, you know, discursive analysis of the representation of the England rugby team and like the, you know, say British, like the English press, doing like when they won the World Cup, and it all feeds into this narrative, like, you know, typical like English narrative, like, you know, bravery, like toughness, you know, honesty, and all this like bullshit about, like, you know, and like basically it's all it feeds into also the public school ethos of it, you know, all, and dedication and hard work and all that stuff.
Neil Back does something sneaky.
And things like that. But it's true. And then I thought, how interesting is it that, you know, Wales, what we tell ourselves is like, oh man, we're shit, we're so bad at football. And what does it mean? What does it mean when most of the nation doesn't actually watch the football team because, like, we've told ourselves that we're actually rubbish at football? That's got to be significant, I think. Yeah. That's got to be like symptomatic of the wider Welsh condition of post-coloniality, in my opinion, because I think it's fairly rare. Because in Scotland, I mean, Scotland have been not great at football, shall we say, as well. Obviously, they've been more successful than us historically.
Yes, we shall. We shall say.
Yeah, because I mean, I don't remember like the Joe Jordan stuff, obviously. But nonetheless, your average Scottish person watching football, you know, isn't going to be like, oh, let's just go and watch England because Scotland is shit. Same in Northern Ireland. Same in in Ireland, obviously. What we think is normal is definitely abnormal, and it definitely says something about the underlying sort of nature of Welshness.
Yeah, and I think that comes through in the film Don't Take Me Home. So, yes, that is celebratory, and let's be honest, we took absolute pelters for the open-top bus thing and everything else. And actually, until or unless you understand exactly the stuff that you've just alluded to, clearly what you write about in the article, that is going to jar. You're going to look at that and go, what?
Yeah.
Can you celebrate? And I think that film nails that. We did the podcast, we were, you know, on the day of the premiere down here with Johnny Owen, and, you know, there was other things going on in his life that day, and I was, and still I'm eternally grateful for his time and doing that. He sort of talked at the time about how he, where do I start that story? Do I start it with, you know, there's these promising crop of young players, but playing in, you know, that Finland game, for example, you know, where do I start it? And decides actually to start it with basically, you know, Gary Speed.
Yeah.
And at the start of the film, you're going in, because you clearly know what the film's about, obviously, you know. You know, no one can ever provide any kind of spoilers for Don't Take Me Home. But you go in thinking, yeah, going to celebrate Euros, yeah, yeah. And it fucking punches you repeatedly in the gut for the first kind of 15 minutes. And it's done very, very, very well. And I just thought, actually, this is anything but heroic. This isn't plucky, you know, minnows against giants, David versus Goliath. It's nothing like that. It's actually, do you know what? It doesn't get any worse than this. It doesn't. And it's getting absolutely pummeled then, soon after in Serbia. And it's, you know, all of it. And you kind of think, this is unrelenting. You know, this...
Yeah, it's relentless, isn't it?
There's a lot of Shawshank before there's any redemption in Don't Take Me Home. And I think the film is all the better for that. But I think what it does, it taps into that almost anti-heroism.
Yeah. I'm guilty of it, of course. Let's not kid ourselves. We still have a very, in the grand scheme of things, in a relative sense, incredibly really weak sense of national identity, like really weak, like in a comparison to other countries. Starting from an even lower base. I mean, you know, we read books, you know, Ash on a Young Man's Sleeve, you know, by Danny Absey about Cardiff, and you read Martin, you know, if you read Martin Johns's books about like Cardiff and things like that, and early Welsh identity, and, you know, it was routine for Welsh people to call themselves as Englishmen, you know, all the way up till like the 40s and 50s. So we've always got to bear in mind that we are starting from a low base and like as a nation. So, you know,
but I think what's interesting as well, so I got 1905 and all that, but Gareth Williams, Barry Boy, Aberystwyth historian, probably kind of retired now or something, I'm not too sure. Really, really nice guy. And my wife studied history up there as well, was a tutor under him. I remember going for a few beers with him in Rummers.
Oh, yeah.
Really nice guy. And there's a bit, and I've kind of flagged it somewhere, but he's talking about, he's quoting a guy called Thomas Jones, who's like a cabinet secretary, but kind of one of those Welsh people that kind of does very, very well in London.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And, you know,
professional Welshman, like.
Yeah, Dick Sean Davids and all the rest of it. Does that thing that Michael Sheen talks about in that brilliant Raymond Williams lecture from 2017, I think. Where he talks about how he goes to order milk. Yeah. I haven't got the accent. And the person at McDonald's or wherever is doesn't understand what he's trying to say. He's just trying to say milk. So he begins to affect his accent.
Mm.
And you touched on, you know, what we do when we're outside. And or at the same time, then you begin to think, actually, this is what I'm doing. And so his identity and sense of nationhood is enhanced by leaving, which is what you touched on earlier. But even back in the early 20th century, you know, it's describing football as this alien game. It's a game of immigrants. It's kind of interesting when you're talking about Wales, football is a game of immigrants, because that's what we hear about in the United States,
yeah,
in Canada,
yeah,
in Australia. So Australia, famously, when Australia played Croatia,
yeah, that was amazing, wasn't it?
Because you had Croatian speaking perfect English,
yeah,
with Australian accent. You had Australian players.
Wasn't it like eight
broken?
Wasn't it like eight on each team?
A bit of sympathy with Graham Paul. It's the only time I ever would. But again, you know, in Canada, so, you know, we did a blog over the Easter break about just an eligible for Wales 11. So players that were eligible for Wales, but for whatever reason opted to play for other countries, maybe weren't good enough. And, you know, you talk about Canada, there's two Welshmen in the squad. One went to the World Cup in 86, one was on the margins. And, you know, they're Cardiff and Swansea born, these
really,
people.
Yeah.
So these countries, and there probably would have been maybe four or five Canadian-born players in the squad around that time. So again, this notion that the game is an immigrant sport, we're kind of comfortable with, or we understand contemporarily within these sorts of countries, but it's the extent to which it was considered an immigrant sport. English immigrants, maybe Irish to a certain extent, but mainly from England, were the ones playing the game. And again, it's that kind of out within Wales, it's that almost like an outsider.
Yeah, definitely. Thing.
So these people probably wouldn't have been chapel goers, nonconformists.
Yeah.
Clearly, if they were immigrants, wouldn't have been speaking Welsh. But they wanted to play a round ball rather than an oval ball.
And it also doesn't tie in at all, really, with this, like, you know, the sense of masculinity, which is obviously a huge issue around, like, not an issue, but one of the main reasons that rugby is so massive in the national imagination is because it's this toughness and all the connotations of rugby and the way it's described. And yeah, it is, football doesn't fall into it at all, really.
But you talk about the flags. Again, I think it's the geographer thing. I've always loved the flags. And to be fair, you see this with England. You don't see Chelsea, you don't see Newcastle, you don't see Arsenal flags. You see Dagenham.
Yeah.
You see Basel.
Yeah.
You see, you know, Skelmersdale. You see Plymouth. You see, you know, I guess English. I mean, England is a much more urban country, clearly, than Wales. You know, the urban condition in Wales is relatively new. But, you know, you quote Boris, Baggett,
those Ken Figgill,
yeah. Guy Wendt, Hansadwin. I mean, these are, with all due respect to people from these places, I'm from Dennis Paris, but, like, you know, these are... I've never seen Dennis Paris flag, which is a note
need to get
self.
On that.
Note to self. That I celebrate. I mean, privately and just internally with myself. And
it's
myself.
Amazing. The flag.
I celebrate that.
The flag thing is amazing. And the thing is about the flag. I mean, the flag is really interesting because I think it's really important. It's maybe more important for someone like me, or maybe dare I say, people from places who aren't. That aren't considered to be particularly Welsh, because you know you're in the sea of like people watching Wales, you know, away. And when all of a sudden, if you put your Porthcawl flag up, all of a sudden, you know, like Porthcawl belongs. Because I was like, my first away was, you know, Brussels, which again is like, you know, late. I'm such a newcomer, so I felt like such a fraud writing the article. But we were like flying my mate Robin's flag, who does the Wales away, or did the Wales away account before he got banned. Rest in peace, soldier. But we did. Yeah, and I remember flying his like Llansadwn flag, and I was like, shit, we need a Porthcawl flag desperately, because you want to be part of like the family, don't you? You want to be part of it, but you also want to represent, just like we represent Wales as ambassadors when we're away, and I think we've very definitely got a sense of ambassadorial like duty, yeah. as I'm sure we'll talk about in a sec, most people do. Similarly, I desperately wanted Porthcawl to be sort of represented within that, you know, when people go like, you know, it's like a nod, like, oh, yeah, fair play. Because, you know, you see Kenfighill flags, and I was like, right, okay, you need to get a Porthcawl one, definitely, because can't let Kenfighill just like represent the.
And that's the thing, see, if there's a Dennis Powers, because I've never seen a Penarth flag either, so immediately you get one over Penarth.
Of course you do, get in there, yeah. And there's loads of Barry flags. But yeah, and then carrying the flag around is awesome, because like we've met now, it becomes like a meeting point, which is awesome, and we've met so many people now from. And Porthcawl's just, you know, a small place, but like, you know, you meet people you don't know who are like away. On like Wales duty, and they just come up to you, oh, I'm from Porthcawl, and then, you know, you sort of meet them again and again. And the other thing I didn't speak about, I mean, like, is, you know, the amazing thing about Wales away is the friends you made along the way. But it really is. I mean, like, you know, I started watching with my mate Mikey, and you know, you eventually sort of the group snowballs. You meet people from, you know, North Wales, and now at the end of this month, you know, I'm off to Croatia and Hungary, and I think we've got, you know, 10 of us going who, you know, I didn't know 2 years ago any of them, and you've got mates for life there from all over Wales, and it's a really, you know, some of them live in London, some of them living in North Wales, some of them living in, you know, Maesteg. It's
and
great.
So, and what you're saying with respect, what you argue, and I wouldn't have needed to argue it to me, but I think what you try to communicate in the article is that Wales Away then breaks down a lot of the social, certainly that just that very physical, because of, you know, distance and you know, just appalling infrastructure, the space, the distance between different parts of Wales breaks all that down.
Of course it
and,
does.
And you know, I think a nice articulation of that is the names of, you know, relatively small communities on these flags that are from, you know, all over.
The first away I did, I remember being in St Pancras, and we got on a bit like, not a snob, but we in St Pancras. And it was what, like, I think 11, about to take the Eurostar over to Brussels. And like, I was like a rabbit in the headlights. You know, we had a few pints. So I was like, oh my God, like, I'm drinking this, like, it's, you know, it's in the day, because I'm so used to working. You know, I've never had any money or any time. And I've actually suddenly got this, like, because I went quite rapidly from like, I was working in a bar all through my PhD to fund it. And then I got a job like almost straight away. The first time I've ever had a salary was when I was like 30. And I was like, oh, I can actually do these things I've always dreamed of doing. Well, I say always dreamed of doing, actually that's rubbish, because I never thought about going to Wales Away, because it just seemed like this ridiculous.
Yeah.
Why would I go, and why on earth would you want to go and do that? But then my mate Robin had been doing it. He was like, oh, I should come to class. Mm. And he was like, oh, what the hell? So we went away. People are steaming in St Pancras, you know, like there's all these old boys from like Cardiff fans from the valleys, just like were hammered. And I was like, oh, here we go. But you know, getting the train, what I thought was amazing, you instantly, you hear the Welsh language, and you know, you've got lads sitting opposite, you know, so the lad, older boys that we're chatting to from the valleys are all speaking English to us. Oh, we, you know, we're talking about Porthcawl and stuff, and we're already feeling like, oh, I, you know, belong here. And then like next to us is like lads speaking Welsh. I don't know, I just didn't expect it to be so seamless. And then when we got to Belgium, I was like, oh man, this is literally, I actually can't believe this. This is unbelievable. Everyone's just mingling in the pub. Mm. Obviously, you know, I went to uni in Aberystwyth for my undergrad. Then I went to Bangor for my PhD. And I don't like Aberystwyth, which I know you don't. You know, but I mean, I absolutely love Bangor. And I think it's one of the best places ever. I had the best time. But, you know, before I went to North Wales for my PhD, you know, I genuinely, hand on heart, thought that, you know, everyone up there would be like very rural, you know, insular and like naive, and I would be there with like an iPod, and you know, and no, but yeah, like, oh, you know, who's this guy coming, you know, but hand on heart thought that's what it would be. And then obviously, you know, you've got a Bangor, and it's an incredibly working class town. Mm. And I was like, shit, this is just like, you know, this is Bridgend, but in North Wales, it's amazing. I had the best time there, but none of my friends or family, I think, have ever really been to North Wales. I mean, people, why would you go north of the M4? Because if you live in Porthcawl, you know, Porthcawl is a commuter town for Cardiff, which is, you know, 45 minutes away, and you know, you don't even go to Swansea. You don't certainly go, don't go to the anywhere north of Porthcawl.
That's the point. I know plenty of people who will very, very seldom ever go north of the M4.
So yeah, well, why? But why? Yeah, why would you?
Because you know, you can put your train ticket or your mileage into expenses because you've got a meeting at Bosco in Merthyr or something. So again, it's a sponsored visit. There's
no reason to go there because everything's agglomerated in Cardiff,
I'll
essentially.
I'll argue there's actually lots and lots of reasons, oh, yeah, but of course. People don't necessarily recognise those clearly. So you multiply that, you know, 100-fold then for, you know, going to Wrexham or...
So when I went to uni in Bangor, I had this, like, awakening. I was like, oh my God, like, this, everyone's exactly the same, really, particularly because I started playing football up there and I was, like, buzzing off the fact that, you know, there's no rugby. And I just thought it was amazing, like the football culture in North Wales was like, fell in love with it. Especially playing as well. You get to see all these amazing places in North Wales and you think, oh, this is exactly the same as back home. So the the clubhouses and things like that, except it's in the Welsh language. And then when I started doing Wales Away, I sort of realised, well, this is actually the only place where people who love football from North Wales are meeting people who love football from South Wales. And you know, it's not just the fact the Welsh language is normalised, it's the fact that everyone's rubbing along brilliantly. And we saw groups of lads from, you know, North Wales hanging out with lads from South Wales, and you could see people just start to chat. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is obviously bound up with casual culture, which I joke to my mates, like, you know, people from North Wales and South Wales, like, don't think you've got anything in common. Then you go away to Wales Away and you realise you actually, like, everyone loves, like, drinking and fighting just the same as everyone else. And it's like, oh, all right, okay. So you sort of bond. But, you know, everyone's wearing the same clothes. You know, everyone's listening to the same music. And so you're sort of brought together by casual culture. And the flag I saw in Brussels outside this, the first bar we rocked up to, I mean, I've seen it since, but it's, like, literally this... It covered the whole of the bar. It's enormous, you know, the big red one with the old Wales crest and then the three stripes. And I was like, well, this isn't necessarily just about like Welsh identity or Welsh culture. This is a really specific subculture that people are sort of bought into. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because it is, you know, there's obviously with like Spirit 58 stuff, there's like a Soul Boys, like a mod under sort of current to that as well. But you know, everyone's wearing like Stone Island, you know, everyone's talking to each other about what jacket they've got on and things like that. And okay, aside from the negatives with like, you know, I've seen like fights between Cardiff fans and Swansea fans and things like that, it's a specific articulation like within a national culture, which I think is quite interesting. There's a sociologist called Tim Aidensore, and he's a geographer, but he's written an amazing book about like everyday nationhood and how, you know, you think about your nation and where you're from, and it's nothing to do with like, you know, national anthems or things like that. It's literally about your everyday life. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like, you know, he always talks about things like roads, you know, like, and you know, if you looked out the window in a foreign country without talking to anyone, you know, you'd know that you're in a foreign country because like the roads look different, you know, the streetlights are different, and you know, the like public transport's different, you know, and everything, a little, like the minutiae of everyday life is completely different. You know, you go to a supermarket in another country as soon as you go on holiday, and that's like this amazing experience, you know, and what I will say about like the Balkans and things, all the countries I've been to, everyone seems to love drinking yogurt. Like, I don't, necessarily get that, but you know, but it's the little things about everyday life that make you aware of the differences and how you know, like brands and stuff like that. But he does this bit about like transnational identities. Like he does a big bit on like surfers and how wherever you go in the world, surfers tend to look the same. You know, so you go like, and it's true because it's like seen as this like calling, and you can go to, you know, like whether you're in the UK, like France, South America, Australia, like, but you know, Japan, they kind of wear the same clothes, they wear the same brands, they've got the same look. And he always,
basically Robert Savage.
Yeah, exactly. And he says that that occasionally those people sort of opt out of the like the specific, they could maybe be seen to opt out of the national identity of the country they're in because their identity is first and foremost like to be like a surfer, or you know, pick another example. I can't think of one necessarily offhand, but what I, you know, what I was thinking about when I went to Belgium and seeing that flag and seeing like everyone like sort of dressed the same, and then when I saw like the Euros, I mean, the ironic thing is about, like, you know, we all say that we're very different from like the English and like the Irish and the Northern Irish and things like that, but then I'm, one of my best mates is from Belfast, and we were like knocking around with him and his mates in Paris and stuff, and you meet, you see all the English lads obviously, and all the Welsh fans and the English fans are essentially dressed exactly the same, you know, like the same brands, the same clothes, into the same music, because football, as we know, is essentially an international subculture, you know. If you pick a football fan from England or Scotland who's quite into football, and from Wales, generally speaking, they're going to be into the same fashion, they're generally going to be into the same music, because that's what sort of casual football casual culture is sort of about. But but obviously the interesting thing about Wales away is it is nonetheless a very specific articulation of that, kind of based on a bit more, less of a,
that's where language begins to make that distinct. So you're still always trying to find, not always, but you know, there's always that notion of, well, okay, well, if we're listening to the same stuff, drinking the same lager, following the same, liking the same spot, we're in the same town, well, why aren't we following England?
Like, yeah, exactly.
So there's always going to be something. I think language is one of those things. But like I say, it's normalised, it's prominent, and it's utterly uncontested.
Yeah.
And it's just unique in well, outside of Melbourne's choirs, is it unique in sort of Welsh life?
I mean, when
so
I,
this principle of egalitarianism is a strong thread throughout the article as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
that notion of internationalism, and that actually, well, North Wales, South Wales, once actually we're given the opportunity to actually, like say, mingle, to socialise, to spend some time with each other's company, you go, actually, we are very similar.
Yeah.
And for most of us, until or unless we begin to spend time in that environment, and it's not, I mean, it's probably, you know, if some examples where that might be allowed to happen, but they are rare, then, you know, they are other. I mean, I can only speak about it from a South Walian perspective, like yourself, in terms of North Wales, it just feels, when you're growing up as a kid in South Wales, it feels a long, particularly, you know, in our generation, 80s, 90s, it feels a long way away.
Oh, well, same generation, me.
I'm stretching out that person generation. And you know, yeah, so, you know, my wife's from Wrexham, she'd never been to South Wales until she met me. I'd never been to North Wales until I met her. And it's that sort of, and I know plenty of other people
with a similar
kind of experience.
I mean, I still, when I started going, I remember went to Belgium, and then we got like a new group of us, like my brother-in-law and his mates, who are all from like the valleys, and we go into, you know, certain pubs in Canton before home games, and like getting really well with these lads, still good friends with them. But I always remember thinking, you know, because we were in these bars, which is like, you know, that's the epicentre of like Welsh-speaking Cardiff anyway, but you know, it was packed full of like Welsh football fans, and I was speaking Welsh, and we were like, their faces are like, oh my God, like people are speaking Welsh, like, you know, like, and I probably wouldn't, you know, if you grew up in like Porthcawl and these other places, you would never literally go your whole life without ever hearing it, like in the wild, so to speak. It's a jarring experience to hear it. I remember interviewing a Welsh language teacher from Porthcawl during my PhD, and this is an angle that always gets lost, how awful it is to be othered in your own country and to have people. So she says, you know, in Porthcawl, you speak Welsh in a supermarket and people look at you as if you've got two heads. I mean, imagine how bad that is. But I just love the fact that we're away and people, it is taken, normal, and it's not, there isn't that like, you know, people don't get the backup. And unfortunately, the reality is that people do.
Mm.
And obviously, you know, as a communist, I don't normally like saying about like something's not focusing on class and saying something's like classless when when it's not. But one of the things I do like about Wales Away is that it doesn't have that like bougie feel to, which is one of the reasons I don't like Aberystwyth and don't necessarily like a lot of things about Porthcawl.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I like Bangor and other places in Wales so much is that, you know, you get everyone sort of tends to be united by like class habitus, you know, because, you know, there's the kind of that like that more jocular sort of less standoffish, you know, everyone just chats to one another and, you know, winds each other up and stuff. And also there's no, it's, you know, people behave badly, but in an, I hate to use it, that, you know, that brand Peaceful Hooligan, which is a bit shit, but you know what I mean? What I noticed,
because there's a danger you can glorify some of that.
Yeah.
And when it does tip over into sort of club on club, you know, violence, then you kind of go, personally, I'd stop a bit short on that personally, but like, but that working class sense of almost like a common hood, if you like.
It's a class habitus. You can't put your finger on it, but you're very similar to the people you're chatting to.
But you're conscious of it, and that's the point, isn't it? Which is, and just because you can't sort of pinpoint it, anchor it to the ground and point at it and go, that's what it is.
Yeah, you feel,
doesn't mean it's any less.
You feel comfortable in the environment, essentially, in a way that you don't otherwise. Well, you know, Bourdieu says, you know, if the habitus, like, fits with the field, you know, you feel like a fish in water, and you know, and if it doesn't, for example, myself in academia, or if you go to other more rarefied places, I'm sure everyone's felt out of place at some stage in their life because of their class. And it's the awesome thing about going to Wales Away is you think, oh, I belong here, these are the people I like chatting to and stuff.
So you touch on Simon Brooks's book Adria, which is a Welsh language book, and it's about his sort of attachment and to and connection with Clwb Peldroed.
I think he's the mascot of Porthmadog.
and talks about how, you know, it's community based. And I think what's interesting, so I did a podcast, I do another podcast, and I'm not going to plug it or anything, but I did one around the, and it looks at community issues, and I did one with Tim Hartley, who, you know, was founding trustee, trustees of Gore Cymru. So again, that ambassadorial role, raising money, going to, you know, disadvantaged, underprivileged children in other countries. And, you know, is another element of that ambassador role. And dealing with Tim and his role as a, so like, I think he's like the Wales rep for Supporters Direct. So an organisation that helps fans essentially organise, collectivise, and to begin to explore taking ownership of their football clubs.
Yeah.
And, you know, the guy from Supporters Direct, who contributed to that podcast, was talking about how in Wales, actually, and I don't know if this is kind of scientific, but sort of almost like, you know, per capita, there's more fan ownership, or there's a greater proportion of fan ownership in Wales than there is in England.
Ah, interesting.
And that to me, I think there's two things. I think there is something a little bit more at the heart of a sense of communalism, community ownership. I think it's also because you've got less, I think you've got less money here.
So yeah,
less,
yeah.
Capitalised forms of finance to just basically come in. There's no Qataris coming in to look to buy, you know, Carmarthen Town. You know,
funny if they did, though.
It would be, yeah. Qatar Airways.
No, just bent businessmen from Liverpool taking over Bangor.
Or John Fashanu at Barry Town. So, you know, it's like we're not immune from those kind of nefarious characters. You know, Wrexham have had tons of them over the years as well, and so on. But it's that sense of there's less impediment to people collectivising, which is not the same as saying there's more money or it's easier, but actually in terms of kind of like class strata, there's, you can just kind of get on and do it. And I think what's interesting is that the fan ownership model has happened in football, but is, with all due respect, is, you know, barely even sentient and nascent within rugby. Yeah, actually the market logic driven model of professional rugby is utterly busted.
Oh, it's broken.
I mean,
it
is utterly busted.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is not going to be recovered other than through patronage. And even that, I'm not sure who's around to put money into it anymore.
And it's the wrong model anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yes, no, and on a geographical basis and everything else, but I'm kind of curious as to why, actually, when you go to, for example, Standon, you know, as I have done, you know, watching the Blues or something, it's more middle class. There's clearly more money in those terraces, in those stands. So why haven't they organised?
Yeah,
and I think there's something that at the heart of it is related to class and access to capital, and it comes through in Simon's book, which I've read as well, and I think that's, I think there's people who kind of recognise that. And again, that's then reflected in things, for example, the names on the flags.
Yeah.
There's that sense of pride in community, the sort of the Mishti Sgwâr, as they say in Welsh, the square mile. And it's that attachment, deep attachment to place.
Absolutely.
Even if it's my tiny little place,
yeah,
you know, that's what Wales Away gives you. And also, I would argue, Wales at home gives you, particularly for those from North Wales travelling down. And the last time you and I saw each other was in the tech end at the race course at the Trinidad game, where we all, you know, a lot of us were reminded or had that first glimpse of the torture of travelling between North and South Wales.
And also the torture of what? A flashback to sort of Wales of yesteryear.
Yeah, and that's I think that's important, but I think what that does is it does begin to create bonds.
I'd never meet a Wrexham until that game. Yeah, I mean, what I was sort of struck by, I mean, and you say that the community-owned model doesn't exist in rugby. I mean, I think the most significant thing is that it doesn't exist, like, within, like, wider Welsh society, if you think, like, you know, so if you look at, like, how we as a nation, like, politically are, you know, I would say, in a relative sense, like, worldwide, you know, extremely docile, very beaten down, you know, since the 80s, since, like, you know, the miners' strike, very low political turnout, very low political engagement, and very, you know, I think it is possible for a nation to have, like, all the stuff knocked out of it, for sure. And especially because, like, ironically, even though we used to have this, like, tradition of, like, let's say anarchism, like, do it yourself, like, with, especially in, you know, the Miners' Next Step, and, you know, obviously the Tredegar, you know, Medical Society, which was the forerunner of the NHS, this, like, community-owned, bottom-up sort of way of organising society. Now we've got so sucked into the party parliamentary system that I think there's a deference of, like, oh, someone else will, it's not someone else will do it for us, that's the wrong way of describing it, it's like it isn't for us to do.
Yeah,
you know, we've sort of internalised the thing that, you know, like, the life and stuff is what happens to us. And I should plug, like, if anyone's interested in anarchism, you know, the fundamental tenet of anarchism is that, you know, you as an individual can, and as a collective of people, small collective of people, can change the world and actually take control of your own, like, destiny. And, like, you're not waiting fundamentally with anarchism to do for something to, you know, you're not waiting for 4 years if you want to change something.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you want to fix your community, you don't go, okay, well, we'll wait for the next local council election and we'll elect this, like, ghoul, and then we'll lobby the local council. You know, they're like, well, no, you should do it, and that's what direct action is. But anyway, that's a digression, but people should read about anarchism for sure. What I was struck by, like, at the Wales Away, and this probably shows how, like, docile I am, I was like, boys, who's putting on all the coaches? You know, who's doing all this reconnaissance and stuff? And they were like, oh, we are, the fans. And it was just, blew me away. I was like, what? Because it was so alien to me. I was like, oh, that's amazing. And politically as well, without wanting to sound racist, there's always been, traditionally within Wales, a cultural division of labour, and there still is, where, generally speaking, English people tend to be the managerial strata and in charge of things.
You see it in Fireman Sam.
Is the station manager English?
Station officer Steele is English.
Oh, I didn't know that. Plummy. So we don't have a tradition, really, of running our own affairs, basically. I mean, the goal is unbelievable. Look at Leonard Morgan. You know, she just literally goes around the world on essentially an extended jolly for the rest of her life now, replacing whatever gravy train rider there was before. What's she do? They light up the towers in Chicago or New York on March the 1st, and that's it. Like, the one thing they could have done all this time was to get Welsh Lamb that special protected status, just like champagne and things like that, and they still haven't managed it. And funny enough, one of my mates, John, lives in DC, and he actually gets invited, because he's from Hollywell, well, Skyview, people are surprised, but he gets invited to all these things, and he said, like, his American colleagues are out there, it's actually laughable how bad our diplomats are, like, selling Wales to the world. And really, it's a jolly, you know, like, just like, I don't know if you're aware of when they did the Wales played South Africa in Washington DC in rugby,
right.
And, like, you know, no one went to it, and it was literally just so these, like, Welsh government apparatchiks could basically have a, you know, this is like their version of selling Wales or whatever. Let's not get into it, but, you know, that's the official government, like, attempt at internationalism. Or you've got Carwin Jones saying that he'd love to bomb Yemen with, like, you know, Theresa May, or you've got RAF Valley training, you know, Saudi pilots to kill kids in Yemen. The politicians who, like, claim internationalism are so abhorrent, and they do such a massive injustice to the term that it's almost, like, become completely meaningless when Welsh Labour use it, because, you know, they're militarists. Mm. But then you've got, you know, a group of Welsh football fans going to orphanages around, you know, Europe, and giving donations and shirts and stuff. And it's actually so moving. And that's what solidarity is. That's what internationalism is. Yeah, it's just working class people getting together, like, making contact and meeting up in person and, like, making bonds. Tim and Reese and all the people who do that have done so much more for Wales. in terms of like who runs it, that's what I just thought. I was just blown away by the fact that Corky and all that just put the buses on, you know, they arrange it, you know, they go out, they liaise with the stewards and stuff, and you just think, this is unbelievable, you know. And then you and then inevitably you start asking the question, well, why the hell can't we do that in all aspects of our life? You know, why can't we just organise a community so like that back home?
That word organising. So you do the sociology and the studying stuff. You know, when I'm not prattling on these, it's, you know, it's community work, it's community development, it's helping communities organise to articulate in the first instance, but then hopefully in some way realise futures that are different to the pasts. And often those are centred around, you know, issues to do with poverty, disadvantage, marginalisation, remoteness in lots of different ways. And a lot of these communities get othered in the same way that I would argue, and Tim talks about this. It's podcast 49 of ours with Tim and I just chatting about Gall Cymru. Fairly short, 20, 25 minutes, and he just explains the charity and how people can get involved and what they're about. And it's really, really good listen. And he talks about how football fans had been, used the word othered. That's what they were in the 80s. You know, they were that
almost
like an enemy within. The same way the miners were described. Subhuman, they were primal, they were animalistic, and obviously they deserved to be caged in,
with
like ID cards, all that sort of stuff.
It was the Millwall versus Luton, wasn't it?
And what Tim et al, and then there are a lot more as well, it's not just him, but you know, Tim tends to be the person who identified. But I mean, Tim, you know, was talking about how actually what we wanted to do was to do something different and actually should portray it in a different light. And I absolutely agree with you, they've probably done more kind of soft diplomacy in some of these countries.
That's exactly what it is.
Than any number of officially sanctioned things. And so for me, that notion of it, of having a sense of community, or communities within, lots of communities can come together and agglomerate then in this way. But actually, the notion that it is us doing this, I think is absolutely at the heart of this. Or it's certainly the bit that appeals to me most, that it's self-organised, it's not patronised. So there's very few things that happen in Welsh civil society that isn't publicly funded, that isn't publicly underwritten, that doesn't have the risk being absorbed by the public purse, that doesn't have political patronage in big and little P terms. But
we don't have any agency. That's the main thing, isn't it? We're just not involved in it.
But the last few years, and the Euros clearly was a stimulus to this, but it wasn't the cause, because it was happening, you know, before we qualified, even before we looked like we were going to be qualifying. It was emerging. I think as well, there is a good, worthwhile, merited shout out to the FAW.
They've harnessed it and they've cultivated it, and they've played an absolute blinder.
That's the thing. So this notion of the red wall that we've all now adopted,
that's
it. Was the players that came up with that. The players that came up with that. The Together Stronger was within that, is my understanding anyway, it was within the FAW, and it was a term we're going to encourage you. But the players took ownership of that.
Yeah.
And then we took. So actually some of this stuff we've actually taken, we've kind of colonised and then expressed in our own.
I guess the red wall, I mean, to extent, I mean, like, that's probably taken, like, and this is why football culture is so amazing, because that's probably, if you think about it, that's probably from like Dortmund, isn't it? It's probably from like the Yellow Wall and things like that. But it's now ours, like, just like chants start, I think Don't Take Me Home was a Newcastle chant, originally, and then but then, you know, that's become indelibly like stamped on the public imagination, or rather, like, you know, that became like our thing, and then we were teaching it to other fans and stuff like that, and it becomes it's interesting how like transposable it is. But we don't have, what is Wales at home in politics and in everyday life, you know, the world sort of happens to you, doesn't it? Stuff happens to our communities. Simon Brooks's book is, well, not that I've read it because I can't speak Welsh, but Simon sent me a translated excerpt, and he makes an interesting thing about class within the Welsh language communities. And the parts of North Wales I know really is like, you know, the Nantlle Valley, you know, Bangor, Penygroes, Carnarvon, and obviously Simon's Port Madog, which is, I think, the end of the Nantlle Valley. And he actually makes a really interesting distinction, because he says that you've got a massive Welsh middle class, you're like Welsh speaking middle class, and he says they have their very important role to play in sustaining Property Bro, the chapel's high cultural events, and he says that's also very important. But he says, you know, the football clubs like Port Madog, you know, are run by local working class people, which is very rare, and football clubs are really important for communities because they anchor people to communities.
Because bonding function, isn't it?
Of course it is. Football club, you know, if you play for a football club, you know, you develop a massive sense of like pride in your town. You meet everyone in your town. Players tend to stay on, coach the little ones, and you start to think, well, you want to live here. And also, if you're not from the town, you join the football club, you become part of the town. It's a huge a massive like it plays a massive like adhesive role within a community in bringing people together. Not just football, you know, like rugby, like you know, boxing, all these things can bring people together in a way nothing else can. But he says that's particularly important in places in like the Clean Peninsula and Port Madoc and things like that, because these are places where you've got a massive exodus of young people, a huge brain drain, and it's actually the football team that communities are essentially dying, they're being ripped apart. And he says the community, the football club, is actually the one thing that actually remains and unites people, and it's also the thing that helps sustain the Welsh language amongst the working class community. So he says that, he basically says that their football is far more important in sustaining the Welsh language in those parts of Wales than, you know, all the other sort of typical cultural apparatuses of the Welsh language, which I thought was like a really interesting point.
Well, that does that challenge is then the traditional notions of the cracker. Which is what is then used as a stick to beat.
Absolutely.
And to exclude and to, well, to other the Welsh language community then within working class Anglophone parts of South Wales.
Yeah, and I always think that, you know, you can't, the cracker thing, you can't really sustain that once you've been on like Wales Away tours and like hung out with like lads from Carnarvon and Bangor and all that, because you're just like, well, these are, it's just just working class people who have, you know, Welsh happens to be the language of the community, so it's an amazing corrective to the false sort of stereotypes. You know, you can't turn around and say, you know, these people are bourgeois people that run in Wales, because it's just a load of rubbish. I did actually get a bit of heat from, like, a lot of people said, like, oh, this article is actually very, I mean, I wanted to write something that was positive, because I don't think I've ever written anything that was positive. You know, what about women, for example? It is quite like overly focused on the male experience, and that is like, it's definitely true. What I will say as well, the FAW have done really well in cultivating like the women's game, and I think we've, and the reason I didn't speak, but I actually wrote a paragraph about the women's game and the place of women in Wales Away and Wales at home, because I think that my article is definitely incomplete and it's myopic, because it like, it excludes all the, it's deliberately excluding all the bad shit you see that happens in every away trip. I mean, you'd have to be blind to not notice some of the terrible things that happen. Recently, there's been some high profile cases on like Twitter of, you know, women saying they've been groped at games and abused and things like that. And I've noticed it myself. I mean, the anecdote I didn't put in there was that I actually left the Moldova game with about half an hour to go because blokes behind me were racially abusing Ashley Williams. And I turned around and like, you know, steaming, which made me even more upset, and I started like kicking off, and you know, no one did anything, and I just walked out of the stadium. It was the most surreal thing ever, because the Moldova end was empty. I remember people saying, "Oh, you know, what's their problem? I wouldn't like football," and then you go actually out the stadium, and it was completely covered with young lads in their teens who'd climbed up to watch, and I remember thinking, like, you know, what was the ticket, like a tenner? That was the first time I felt a bit, you know, uncomfortable about the whole experience, because we're there en masse getting steaming in this very impoverished country. I don't want to watch Wales, because I was so upset, because everything that I'd built up in my head about this being this, you know, progressive travelling statelet and all that, I don't want to over-egg the pudding, because if Wales Away is like a travelling statelet, then you will get all the problems of a statelet eventually. Yes. And there were definitely some people, particularly in Moldova, who I thought were just dickheads. I came back and I said, you know what, I don't know if I'm going to go again. But that, me being a political, you know, being an anarchist, being a nationalist, I definitely probably have projected all these things. And I know that my experience of Wales Away is obviously not, you know, the same as everyone else's. And I know a lot of people, if I said, oh, it's just travelling statelet, they'd be like, what are you on about? Like, stop talking shit. You know, it's just about getting steaming.
Yeah, but you're giving the people the opportunity via this to consider it in other ways, and if they choose not to do that, or they do and then they reject it, then that's absolutely fine.
I think for you, for me, and I think for a lot of people, the ambassadorial side of it is clear. Not just, no one knows who Wales is, you know, everyone always thinks we're English, and we've got like, we've always had this like sense of duty to go away and behave, you know, not going to behave well, let's not, you know, kid ourselves, you know, football fans don't generally behave in normal ways, but behave in ways that are, I would say, benign and are funny, you know, and like, you know, you go to other places and like, okay, yes, you're getting drunk, but you're having a good time and you're being nice to the locals. You know, there's a sense of respect. That was what I always thought.
Yeah.
You know, you're respecting the country you're in. You're not taking the piss.
But I also think that, so yes, you're being an ambassador in an external sense when you're going away, leaving Wales, going to these countries. But actually by you, me, other people standing up and then facing down racism, because
absolutely, yeah,
if someone is racist to Ashley Williams in Moldova, chances are they have racist views when they're at home, in the pub,
absolutely,
watching a local game, having their hair cut, going around the supermarket. So football is perhaps, for them, feels like a safer space to be able to do that. So there's an internal ambassadorial role as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sort of fans self-organise, and then they can begin to challenge that stuff as well. So when the stuff happened in Ireland and Copenhagen, more or less within, you know, a very short period of time, they're isolated, but even isolated is too many.
With the women
yeah. Talk about it becoming more like a stag do, and
definitely
quite loutish and yobbish, etc.
Yeah, it's the yobbish bit, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the thing.
And, you know, sort of message boards and on social media, this notion that, well, you know, the FAW has to do something about it.
Yeah,
you thinking, can't. Well, actually, no, we cannot pick and choose the good bits of the Red Wall and go, oh, it's us and it's brilliant. We have to stamp out. So I got in touch with Jason from Show Racing the Red Car and said, listen, here's a platform for you. It ain't going to change the world. It's not going to get rid of this problem. It's not a magic bullet, but it might be a window into your work and why you do what you do and how you do it. And Jason was great because he's talking about, well, it's education. This is not about coming down like a ton of bricks on people.
Yeah.
It's about chipping away and just presenting and portraying other ways of essentially understanding different races, ethnicities, etc. And so I think it begins and it ends with us. It can be helped and maybe funded in the case of charities like Show Races and the Red Card by the FAWs and the Welsh governments and the councils, etc., etc. But actually, I think we cannot absolve ourselves.
No,
we cannot,
it has to be us.
We cannot pick and choose which bits, like you said, of that statelet then that we articulate, we create, we drive, we sustain, and then others that we kind of go, oh, that's someone else's responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. What I will say, I mean, as you get bigger, as we get better, as it becomes like, I think Wales always gone from being like a niche activity to almost like a rite of passage for a lot of like young football fans in Wales now, which is great. I am worried that we are going to get a lot more of that element. I don't want to blame young people because it's not that at all, but there is, you know, the problem.
To a certain extent, is there not a needing to learn how to conduct oneself.
Yeah, exactly. And so I remember being, but this is the problem when you talk about self-policing, like how do you self-police this statelet whilst remaining harmonious and like peaceful? I mean, I always remember in Bosnia hearing a story about a younger person being put in his place in no uncertain terms because of his behaviour, but even that is obviously deeply problematic. I do worry about it, for sure. I mean, I've only been to like eight away, so you know, I can only imagine what it must be like for people who were there when it was like a real train spotting experience. But there is a little part of me that thought, you know, it might be good to get a couple of thrashings, so it goes back to being a little.
I've heard people echo that. But it would be great if this begins to propagate other articles, other perspectives. I wanted to put a shout out to the Welsh Soccerites, got hold of their first edition.
Yeah, amazing.
That looks at it a little bit more horizontally, vertically. It goes, you know, really digs deep into the pyramid, the domestic game, and I think that's really important to give that a voice. And there's loads of other stuff. You've got Coleman's Dream, you've got View from the Ninja and Dragonheart with Wrexham, you've got all those club related Jack Cast, I suppose I've got to be inclusive of all of them. Clubs, is there a Newport one? I'm sure there is, but you know, you've got all that with the club scene. We don't tend to touch that stuff. And I think that is important because, like you say, you know, media, you know, the media in Wales is pretty, it's in a pretty parlous state, and I don't see it improving anytime soon. And when you see some of the solutions that come out of the Welsh government, it's around them funding stuff, and then again, it's this old fashioned patronage.
Yeah.
I mean, that ain't the answer, you know. So, you know, what we do is, it's not perfect, and talked about sort of female voices, absolutely, more ethnic minority voices, etc., etc. You know, I think we're still really quite early days in a lot of this, I think.
Well, yeah, definitely.
And so, you know, there's a huge amount to improve on, and I know there's sort of efforts to try to improve the, not improve, but to maybe increase the extent to which people kind of collaborate and collectivise and share, and I think that's kind of great. But if people take issue with the article, then write your own, I'm sure. Emily will accept, you know, will consider all that.
No, I don't want any rebuttals. Like, I guess the one thing I haven't talked about, and what the female voice and, you know, their bad experience is really important to think about, is that, you know, historically, like, Welshness has been inaccessible. We know that. We know Welshness has always been seen as like this. It's been related like either to the Welsh language or to like this valley's like masculine identity. It's been seen as very white, very macho, and it's been seen as completely inaccessible, not just for people from, you know, I have this angst about, oh, I'm not from, you know, Portugal's not that Welsh, you know. But the reality is, like, if I find like Welshness inaccessible, or have found it inaccessible, then, you know, for women it's also very inaccessible. For, you know, ethnic minorities, it's really inaccessible. And football is important because it actually is a way of bringing people who feel excluded like into the nation, and like that's why it's so important that, you know, the team itself is multicultural. And the fact is that you've got lads who are born in England who've grown up as English, you know, and got English accents playing for us, no problem. You know, they're as Welsh as everyone else. And Welsh football has this amazing potential of bringing people together and, like, integrating people into, like, the nation who were currently sort of feeling excluded. And, yeah, the Welsh government's attempts, they haven't recognised how powerful it could be at harnessing that. Their response to the Euros was, like, a bit crap, I thought, you know. Yeah, and they just didn't, because these are people who are used to going to, you know, rugby games and just going on the piss and, like, you know, meeting Prince William and stuff, they're not used to seeing this, like, bubbling up of, like, popular, accessible sort of Welshness, which is really telling, you know, that they didn't really know what to do with it. It was, like, almost like a completely anathema to everything they've sort of knew. They're like, oh, well,
you know. And everyone was winning the Grand Slam. Oh. Back on safe territory again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank goodness. You know,
Listen, best of luck with the continuing recovery from academia.
Oh, yeah, thanks, mate. Yeah.
A little bit of housekeeping. So, yeah, so I referred to the Eligible for Wales blog that that put out of Rista. Talking about Wales away, obviously, a lot now. Leon put a blog out around where he thought Wales is 10 best, 10 greatest away wins. So there's a bit of content on there, because we've not been hugely productive and prolific on the podcast side of things, but the written form is ticking along quite nicely. What's next for you, Dan?
We've got a podcast coming out. We just released the ones on Lesbians and Gays Support the Minors, which is, like, a very emotional podcast. I actually, like, broke down and wept midway through, and that was, like, edited out because I've just got so emotional talking about it, like an example of, like, solidarity and humans coming together, which is the best thing, isn't it? But yeah, that was edited out. But I think we might put that on Patreon. if you want to just hear hear a minute of me, like, just sobbing. We've got a podcast coming out on neoliberalism soon. We've got one coming out on Raymond Williams. I've got a couple of chapters coming up, but they're in academic textbooks. The thing is, I'm stuck in this, like, purgatory where I've still got, like, academic commitments. You know, I've still got, like, chapters that I started writing. So, yeah, pray for me, really. But yeah, that's it. A few articles in the pipeline. And oh yeah, I got tickets for Croatian Hungary, so obviously nice, I'm going there. So,
last word, I want to wish Simon Shakey all the best. He's not been in great health, he's been in hospital. The man is an absolute giant, and he's got to make a full recovery, because we're all waiting for his shirt book for our Santa lists. Nothing else is on my Christmas list. So all the best, Shakey. There are a lot of people rooting for you. And please make a speedy recovery. So until next time, we'll probably do one in next week or two about the games.
Yeah.
Safe trip to everybody else. And remember, you're ambassadors.
Absolutely, yeah.
So take lots of Ferrero Rocher, yeah? Is that what you do?
I just give the bucket hats away, or they get, like, I don't know, I end up, like, giving them to a kid or something. And I always just, so I'm keeping Tim Williams in business, because I always have to buy a new one when I come back.
Okay. Dan, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Russ. My pleasure.